Welcome to Mythic Imagination. I'm Honora Foa, and happy Valentine's Day. In keeping with the tradition, our topic for tonight's podcast is love. Love is truly the never-ending story. The experience of love is the way into understanding the language of myth and story itself. When you love, there is nothing that is more real. Yet in and of itself, there is no smell, no taste, no image, no touchable material to point to and say, this is it, this is love, this is my love. We recognize the shape of our love as it takes on the forms of imagination and action, but we know that is not exactly the thing itself. Because nothing is more important, because we would die for love, we have instinctive understanding that reality is deep and wide, and that the reality being brought to us in a story can be more powerful than the reality of the material world. If you listen to stories in the light of your knowledge and experience of love, they will begin to reveal their wealth, and in turn, they guide us more deeply into the ways of love. Tonight, we will speak with four storytellers, all award-winning authors, about all kinds of love: spiritual, romantic, mortal and immortal love, human, animal, oatmeal, natural, devotional. This list could go on and on. Tonight, we'll speak with O.R. Melling from her home in Ireland to talk about the theme of love in her books.
Well, I always have love story inside my books, and I actually think that high romance is part of high fantasy. Of course, the word romance comes from the old word romance, which belonged to story rather than romantic love. It belonged to the stories like the Arthurian stories, the great romances.
Recently, a researcher asked 6 to 8 year olds for their definitions of love. Here's one of my favorites. When you love somebody, your eyelashes go up and down and the stars come out of you.
I think I've always said that lovers see each other as gods. You know, something happens when you fall in love. Somebody once talked about a strange cataract comes over the eyes and the world sparkles and shimmers, and the lover is always more than human. You know, they become this immortal in the eyes of, you know, that's the beloved with a capital B.
Orla, is love so important and all-pervasive that you can't have a good story without it?
I don't like to read stories that don't have a love story in them, and I think all the greatest stories do contain a love story, whether it's the Arthurian myth or the Lord of the Rings, or I can't think of a wonderful myth that doesn't contain a love story in it. You know, even the Mahabharata, the great Indian myth, or the Mabinogion, the Welsh myths, there are always love stories in there. And, of course, Tristan and Isolde, one of the great love stories that reflected Lancelot and Guinevere.
In Tristan and Isolde, these types of lovers are willing to risk everything for the sake of true love. Do you think it's only women who enjoy reading those get-swept-off-your-feet kind of love stories?
People say it's just women who like romance. I think that's a certain kind of writing that women, you know, like to read that men don't. But I still think men like a good love story as well. You know, the Lord of the Rings is in fact a lot of people call it a boy's story. You know, and yet two of the great love stories in it are Faramir and Eowyn and of course Arwen and Aragorn. So even even the so-called boy stories have romance in them. And so, yeah, always my characters, my young women, fall in love with young men, and young men fall in love with them, and that is part of their adventure. I suppose love is part of life's journey, life's adventure, and life's quest, and it's one of the magical things that happen on the road of life.
That's a beautiful way to put it, that love is one of the magical things that happens on the road of life. Why is it important to have magical experiences in life? What is magic, anyway? Magic is the practice of transformation. if the road just goes on and on, in a sense, nothing happens. It is the transformation of the traveler that is the point of the journey, and love is the strongest magic. Since this Western notion of romantic love seems so condensed in the imagery of Valentine's Day, let's speak with another author who will be at Mythic Journeys this June, Sobhanfu Somme. The life of the community in Sobhanfu's native Burkina Faso is still very strong. Her sense of the gods and goddesses of love immediately expands beyond the two souls of Western romance.
I really think that when you go down to the base of it, the myth around love or the god and the goddesses around love, they're really all down to this, the same. It's often the clothes that we make them wear that often make this story a little different. But definitely, you know, the love goddesses and God in Africa are an everyday reality. I know that in some parts they have specific dates for them, but I know in my culture, for instance, that it is to be an everyday relationship between the self, the collective, and by the collective, the living, the dead, all of that. That we ought to have a healthy relationship with the gods and goddesses of love and so forth. And to make them be fitted into a particular day would be defeating the purpose of their presence in our life and so forth. And I have come to realize that sometime maybe that's part of the reason why that all of us, we feel this energy of love. We hear, you know, this song of love, whether we are alone in community, because the goddesses and the gods of love are alive in us each day, each breath we take. And so we cannot, even with the best of our ability or confining them onto February 14th, that we can't actually do it. We are always going to be reminded that they are present and that we have to work with them, that we have to use their energy and make them a part of our everyday life and so forth. And so, yes, there are some differences, but really at the core of it, everything is down to the same.
Sobhanfu, thank you for sharing this unifying vision of mythic traditions. Now let's turn from Africa to California, where Peter Beagle is on the line. Peter, you're a writer and a prolific one, and we know you're getting ready to release a new novel called Summer Long. Do you find certain themes cropping up regardless of what you think you're going to write about? And is love one of those themes?
Certain things show up regularly in my work. I was writing about this last night, as a matter of fact, in a general foreword for a collection. Everybody leaves fingerprints, everybody leaves literary DNA behind. And I know, for instance, that music and cats and very old goddesses seem to turn up in my work a lot with Summer Long. At least I got rid of the cats.
That's an interesting thought, literary DNA. So following this thread, if love goddesses had DNA, what would it be like?
Probably have an extra strand, for one thing, instead of the usual double helix. I don't know, because I know that love is so much a part of individual cultures that sometimes it's not recognizable in another culture.
Do you remember what Rabbi Yossi New shared at Mythic Journeys 2004? The idea about sustainable love he calls stirring the oatmeal love? How can we picture the love that warms the house?
There's a classic scene in the musical Fiddler on the Roof, where Tevye becomes aware that his daughter wants to marry somebody, not because he'll get her out of this bad place, this shtetl she's living in, not because he's wealthy, not because he's a great scholar. Nothing like that. She just inexplicably loves him. Tevye is trying to take in the concept of romantic love, and he goes to his wife and asks, Golda, do you love me? And she just looks at him and says, go lie down, you're upset, it's been a rough day. And says, no, really, I'm asking you, do you love me? And she just looks up at the sky. It says, 25 years I've lived with him, slept with him, fought with him. You know, 25 years my bed is his. If that's not love, what is? And finally, in the course of the duet, they rather grudgingly, because the word is so new to them, admit that they love each other. Of course they do. And both of them sing, it doesn't change a thing, but even so, after 25 years, it's nice to know. So it all depends on what your culture thinks of as a reason for love.
Okay. There are many archetypes of love. It seems like you can't throw a stick or shoot an arrow without it landing at the feet of Venus.
As for goddesses, well, again, it depends on the culture. There's some goddesses in Asian cultures you really don't want to fall in love with, attractive as they are, because you could get eaten. And then there is the classic Aphrodite. And Aphrodite really does love the different men she gets involved with for however long. She loves them all. It's ironic that the one she has the longest relationship with and is probably most in love with is the god of war, Ares. And this in spite of the fact that she's married to, you know, the great blacksmith of the gods, Hephaestus, who's ugly and dwarfish and immensely talented at what he does. There's nothing he can't make for you. Nothing in the universe, really. Give him a hammer and the right material. And Aphrodite doesn't care, you know, what he knows about their escapades. And it doesn't matter how humiliated he is or how much he humiliates her whenever he gets a chance to. It doesn't matter. Can't speak for Aphrodite, but he loves her. It's that complicated and messy a thing.
Do archetypes always have a hand in love?
The novel, Summer Long, has to do with interplay between a middle-aged couple who take a youngish girl, into their garage, which nobody's using for much anyway, which she cleans up and makes livable very nicely. And they very gradually come to realize that what they've got there in the garage is Persephone, making a break for it, as she does periodically every millennium or so. And inevitably, when this happens, eventually Hades has to come looking for her. And mixed into all this is the fact that the woman of the middle-aged couple has a daughter by a previous marriage who's gay and who falls in love with Persephone. And that caught me by surprise. If I'm particularly proud of anything in the book, it's the way that worked out, Lily and Persephone, the scenes between them, because Lily is utterly hopeless romantic love, and Persephone responds to it and feels it and believes it. She just has, being a goddess, a somewhat different definition of love. And but in the same way, the Hades, who knows perfectly well what he is and what his assignment in the universe is, and knows perfectly well that he kidnapped Persephone as a child under circumstances that today would be called rape and kidnapping, all the same, Hades loves her. And Persephone knows he does. And it's been like that for thousands and thousands of years. I guess what I'm saying in all this is that good can come from evil, evil from good, from the best intentions, and that love really does crop up in the damnedest places, whether you can explain it or not.
Thank you, Peter. As we put this program together, we wanted a well-rounded program about all kinds of love. But for whatever reason, what emerged weighted itself toward animals. Love between human beings is a very complex business. Rashad Field, the Mevlevi Sheikh, once suggested perhaps it would be best if we practiced love first with rocks, then plants, moving on to a cat or a dromedary. And here with the creatures, something quite different opens up, because animals, of course, are anima, souls. They, like we, are souls. So many of the mythical stories, folk tales, and romances are about love between Beauty and the Beast, gods who take the forms of animals, human beings who are transformed into animals. In these tales as well, we are practicing to love another human being in all his or her glory, in completeness as an animal, mineral, vegetable, and god. Okay, since we've been talking about love of mythic proportions, let's turn our conversation to an aspect of love that's really big. King Kong. With us on the phone is a unique specialist in stories, a manuscript editor. Susan Mary Malone joins us from her home in Ennis, Texas. Susan, you've been a journalist and an award-winning author, and as well an editor of all types of manuscripts, including those juicy titles called romance fiction. Psychologist Robert Johnson talks about that kind of love. He says that we have concretized the symbols in these stories about true and forbidden love, and that instead of taking them literally, we should look at these stories as psychological and spiritual tales of our inner world. How is metaphor at work in the story of King Kong?
King Kong is one of those symbolic creatures in literature that speaks so profoundly to especially the woman's psyche, because King Kong is the forbidden love, so to speak. It's the same love that we find in Beauty and the Beast, and it speaks to a woman's deep need for the attachment to the original object of her affections, which would be her father. And all women have this, all little girls feel this, and as they begin to develop and begin to become from babies to small children and begin to go through the Oedipal process, the first attachment, which was to mom, sort of begins to wane, and we begin to have this attachment to the male figure, to our dads, and begin to want to have a love interest with that figure. And once that process gets in place, we would assume the mother figure go on and leave, and so we could have dad all to ourselves, which psychologically at that point of development is very normal, but it also is unattainable. And King Kong and Beauty and the Beast, those stories bring that into focus, because here is the love interest being something that doesn't work. We look at King Kong and in the movies, the female, the beauty, is taken by force, which is an entirely different subject matter that we could get into later if we wanted to. But it makes that love then, quote, okay, because once that we are abducted into that, it takes our guilt away, and we no longer have that guilt, and we can tame this big, powerful, incredible force just with our love. because the beast always falls in love with the beauty. That, too, is one of the things that we want desperately to have happen. And so when you have the archetype going on there, you don't have to worry about guilt because you were taken, quote, forcefully against your will. This was not a choice that you made. And you can then allow that love to develop and allow that great burning attachment that all girls feel to come from the outside to you. One of the other wonderful things about this archetypal relationship is a child feeling these feelings, and those feelings are still in a grown woman, whether she's, I should say grown, in a developing woman into middle age, is that we long for not only the, quote, bad boy, the big, powerful male figure, the big, powerful beast figure, and all girls will sort of have some of that. But what we really want is for our love, our nurturing, to turn that bad boy back into the innocence of profound love. And we see that in creatures. We think of the love of, our dogs or our cats or our gorillas as being intrinsically very innocent. They don't have the tainted, not the tainted psyche so much, but the tainted kind of neuroses that come with adulthood. Their love is pure, it's innocent, and we all crave that. And that's one of the most wonderful things about these stories is that by this being falling in love with us, as women, and by us being able to somehow return that love, we then restore it into the innocence of childhood, into the innocence of a pure love, unmarred, untainted by all the baggage that we carry, all the real life that we carry, and it's the stuff that fantasies are made of.
Well, if we've seen the movie, any of its versions, we know that King Kong gets it in the end. There's that incredible last line, "It wasn't the airplanes, it was beauty killed the beast." So why does Kong have to die? Couldn't the lovers run off and live happily ever after in the jungle?
One of the other interesting aspects about this story is that Kong does have to die in the end. And archetypally speaking and psychologically speaking, as we go through these passages, that love, that forbidden love for father ultimately has to die for us to successfully navigate the entire Oedipal passage. So, and that's one of the saddest things about childhood. It's why the story itself is so heartbreakingly sad and why every time I see it I cry, is because we have to give up that childhood wish for the father. And it's so powerful, it's so deeply ingrained in us as human beings that it is a literal death in our psyches. And again, one of the saddest passages we ever have to make, but if we don't make it, if Kong doesn't die, then we live our lives trying to recreate that relationship, which can never have a successful outcome. And if we reach the goal, if we get what our heart desires, then we now call that incest, and it comes up, it brings with it such an enormous, enormous ball of wax of problems. So, you know, as sad as it is, and Kong has to die. If Kong doesn't, we're in deep, deep trouble. But the good news is that he always does die in the story, and then we can go from there into normal development, and then hopefully fall in love at some point with a male who has all the attributes, the good attributes of that first love, of that forbidden love, but with a real true life male who is a peer.
Thank you, Susan. As we find our way to the fullness of love for each other, for the world, for God, the directness of feeling we find in animals can move us as deeply as the great romances. Here is a story about two creatures Peter Beagle had the privilege of knowing.
I've had animals most of my adult life, and I know something about animal devotion. The best thing I can say is that when my first wife and I moved into a shack with the three kids, it was a shack in the beautiful hills north of Santa Cruz, the shack came with a dog who was belonged to the landlord's brother, who was never around, and the dog's best friend was a pigeon, a very big fat pigeon, because she ate his dog food, and she slept with him. Sometimes he'd squish her, and he rolled over, and she'd cluck to herself and make pigeon noises and move a little away, but she never left him. And wherever I went with him, trotting along, she'd follow. Even if I couldn't see her, I could hear her wings. She was the size of a football, and I always thought it was a struggle for her to get into the air. But she went where he went. And I used to think that she pecked and nibbled at him, as I'd see her doing, because she was eating bugs in his fur. And I gradually realized, first, he didn't have any bugs in his fur, and secondly, those weren't the sort of bugs she ate. That wasn't her diet. It was just a gesture of affection, like contact, like apes, chimpanzees grooming each other. He died of a very rare disease carried by a tick that had bitten him. And the pigeon died very shortly after, for no cause that we could ever see. You hesitate to say that a big, fat, dog food-eating pigeon the size of a football died of a broken heart. But at this point in my life, I'm willing to say that's what I think.
Mythic Imagination is a production of the Mythic Imagination Institute. The sound designer for Mythic Imagination is Brad Barnett. Special thanks to Creative Digital Group for the generous use of their studio. Find them on the web at creativedigitalgroup.com. The producer of Mythic Imagination is Donna Barnett. Our musical introduction is by Jeffrey Armus. He can be found on the web at jeffreyarmus.com, GeoffreyArmes. It was an honor speaking with our guests. O.R. Melling is the author of The Chronicles of Fairy, which includes the award-winning title Hunter's Moon. Her new book, Summer King, is being released this spring. Orla will join us at Mythic Journeys in June. She can be found on the web at www.ormelling.com. Peter Beagle is the author of the fantasy classic The Last Unicorn. His latest work, Summer Long, will be released this year. Peter was at our last Mythic Journeys conference and will be returning in June. Visit Peter on the web at www.conlanpress.com, Conlan Press. Sabon Fusome, who was raised in the West African Dagara tribe, will also be at Mythic Journeys. She is the author of The Spirit of Intimacy, Ancient African Teachings in the Ways of Relationships, Welcoming Spirit Home, and Falling Out of Grace, What We Learn About Life's Challenges. Find her on the web at www.sabonfu.com, SOBONFU. Susan Mary Malone of Malone Editorial Service specializes in developmental editing for fiction and nonfiction. Visit Susan on the web at www.maloneeditorial.com, MALONEEDITORIAL. To find out more about Mythic Journeys, visit our website, mythicimagination.org. Thank you so much for listening. We'd love to hear your insights and suggestions. Please email them to info@mythicjourneys.org. Tonight, we'll leave you with a very special Valentine, a poem by the 13th century Sufi poet known as Rumi. Ode 314, translated by Coleman Barks. Those who don't feel this love pulling them like a river. Those who don't drink dawn like a cup of spring water or take in sunset like supper. Those who don't want to change. Let them sleep. This love is beyond the study of theology, that old trickery and hypocrisy. If you want to improve your mind that way, sleep on. I've given up on my brain. I've torn the cloth to shreds and thrown it away. If you're not completely naked, wrap your beautiful robe of words around you and sleep. Remember, at Mythic Imagination, every life is a story, and a story can change the world.